This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Stephen Frears, directed the films My Beautiful Laundrette, Prick Up Your Ears, The Grifters, High Fidelity, Dirty Pretty Things, and Mrs. Henderson Presents. His new film, The Queen, reflects on the place of the monarchy in contemporary England in an era when the public and the media are obsessed with celebrity. The film is set in the week following the death of Princess Diana, when thousands of people have gathered in front of the palace to mourn her. But the Queen insists on trying to keep the death a quiet family affair and withdraws from the public. The new Prime Minister, Tony Blair, sees the public response and tries to convince the Queen she needs to emerge and acknowledge the public's grief. The Queen is played by Helen Mirren, Blair by Michael Sheen. Sheen also played Blair in a film Frears made for British television. In this scene from The Queen, Blair calls the Queen after Diana's death.
Good morning, Your Majesty.
May I say right away how very sorry I am?
Thank you.
Is it your intention to make some kind of appearance or statement?
No, certainly not. No member of the royal family will speak publicly about this. This is a private matter.
I don't suppose anyone's had time to think about the funeral yet.
We've spoken with the Spencer family, and it is their express wish that this should be a private funeral.
Right.
And the public, ma'am?
The British people?
You don't think a private funeral might be denying them a chance?
A chance to what? This is a family funeral, Mr. Blair, not a fairground attraction. I think the Princess has already paid a high enough price for exposure to the press, don't you? Now, if there's nothing else, I must get on. The children have to be looked after.
Well, goodbye, Your Majesty.
Stephen Frears, welcome back to Fresh Air. What interested you in the angle of this movie?
Well, it was the idea of writing a film about the Queen. I mean, no one's ever made a film about the Queen.
Is that
so
right?
It was very, very... No. It's me, no. Absolutely shocking thing to suggest. So in that sense, it was incredibly interesting.
Why is it shocking to even suggest it?
Because she's the Queen. She's my queen. She's not your queen. I can see you got rid of her, but she's my queen.
Well, that's the thing. You know, I think Americans don't really quite understand the place of the queen in English society, in English
culture.
It
is very, very hard to explain because it is so contradictory to the notion of democracy. No, we're governed. We're ruled by the... I'm not a citizen. I'm a subject, which is very, very galling and humiliating. You have a head start on me. But we're ruled over by this family in this extraordinary way. How much power they have is more complicated.
Now, when the film begins, Tony Blair has just been elected Prime Minister.
Yes.
And he goes to meet the Queen. And yes. He wants his government to be very informal. He is the Queen's 10th Prime Minister. Her first was Churchill. And their styles are completely opposite. She is very...
Well, he was...
Go ahead.
He was elected on a very modernizing platform. You know, he came in saying he was going to change everything, which Britain needed at the time. And he was enormously popular, won a huge majority, and was thought to be in touch with the people.
So he comes in as, like, popular figure, in touch with the people, call me Tony, very informal. Mm. And the Queen is, of course, all about emotional reserve and traditional formality.
Yes, absolutely.
And, you know, they're in a couple of scenes together, but mostly the Blair scenes and the Queen scenes are separate. And
yes.
It's almost as if you're making two different movies, shot in different
styles,
with different... It's like two completely different styles of filmmaking. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, the royal family that week were up in their house in Scotland. Well, their house in Scotland is like sort of fairyland. It's very, very remote, rather sort of old-fashioned, rather Germanic, you know, very like Disneyland, big towers on the buildings and things like that. They were completely cut off. So, yes, we did shoot it in a different style to illustrate their sort of isolation.
So are there things that you did in terms of the filmmaking to shoot the Queen's scenes and the Tony Blair scenes differently?
Yes, I shot the Tony Blair on 16mm and I shot the Queen on 35.
What's the difference between the two and why did you do that?
Well, 16mm, which I don't think you use a lot in this country, but in my country it's much more sort of demotic. Most of television is shot on 16mm, or it was shot on 16mm. 35mm is a much more beautiful, you know, image that you associate much more with Hollywood movies. So it was really to demonstrate the difference between the two worlds.
You know, I think one of the questions the film asks is, like, what's the role of the royal family in an era of celebrity. I mean, the royals were like the celebrities in a way, but now we have TV and we have movie stars to gossip about, celebrities have kind of like replaced the royal family in some ways.
And I'm sorry, I thought you were going to ask me what the role of the royal family was in a democracy. Apart from the Queen, the children are all treated like celebrities. Diana was treated like a celebrity. And they fit effortlessly into celebrity. But it's their role in democracy that is eccentric and peculiar.
Well, do they have a role in the democracy? I thought their role was to be celebrities, you know, but to be a different kind of celebrity than...
Well, that's right. But, of course, the Queen doesn't like that.
Uh-huh.
She resists that. She's never given an interview in her life.
Never? Wow.
No. No.
So is there an official role for the royal family in a democracy?
Only in the most peculiar and complicated and British sort of way. It is most mysterious how it all works. Of course, the events of the film, that's the only time really in my life when the Queen's ever been criticised and appeared to get something wrong and to misjudge the mood of the country. Normally, she gets it right and is praised for that.
And she was criticised for withdrawing the family for private grief as opposed to joining with the public
in sharing their grief. For not realising what the public wanted, that the public wanted something more demonstrative and the Queen wasn't capable of doing it or didn't at first want to do it and was very reluctant.
Now, Helen Mirren is incredible as the Queen your movie, The Queen. Mm. And... she's an unlikely choice in some senses and a perfect choice in others. I mean, she already played the first Queen Elizabeth. Mm. At the same time, she's also famous for her roles as sexually kinky women.
Sexy women, yes.
Yeah. I mean, and two of the movies I can think of are The Cook, The Thief, Her yep. Wife and His Lover, and also Paul Schrader's film, The Comfort of Strangers.
Yes.
So tell me about casting her.
Well, Helen wasn't my idea. She was really the producer's idea. He also produces Prime Suspect. And I think he said that one day, sitting in a reading for Prime Suspect, he thought that Helen, in a certain light and from a certain angle, looked like the Queen. So he came to me and said, would I be interested in making a second film about Tony Blair, this time about these events, and with Helen playing the Queen. So Helen and I met, and I thought she'd be very good. I can't pretend I gave it a lot of thought. She just seemed a very good idea.
Are there things you told her about what you wanted from her in the role?
No. If you're British, you know, the Queen has been in my life for 60 years. So I don't really have to talk about her a lot. The Queen will have been in Helen's life for more or less the same amount of time. You know, she's absolutely part of our national psyche. I mean, I guess you don't have anybody like that in America because you don't have a permanent head of state. But she's, you know, if you post a letter in Britain, there's a picture of the Queen on it. So she just is part of our lives. So we start from a sort of common basis of an enormous amount of knowledge. You know, we know a lot about the Queen. At the same time, of course, we know nothing about the Queen. So there wasn't really one of those sort of conversations that you can imagine.
Yes. You know, there was My Beautiful Laundrette about a Pakistani immigrant in England who's gay. There's Prick Up Your Ears about the playwright Joe Orton. Mm. And, you know, jumping ahead to more recently, we have High Fidelity about a used record store owner.
Yes.
Dirty Pretty Things about illegal immigrants in England living in this kind of world in which they try to stay invisible. And that's a thriller, and I'm leaving out a lot of films in between. But I mean, there's such a great contrast between the Queen and High Fidelity. You know, between like, you know, the Queen's.
Maybe Jack Black should have played the Queen.
Yeah, the Queen's palace and like the used record store that High Fidelity is set in. High Fidelity is based on a novel by Nick Hornby, and in the movie, John Cusack plays the owner of a used record store who always makes top 10 lists. Not only of his favorite records, but even of like his top 10 worst breakups and top 10 best girlfriends. They're really top fives. I always call them top 10s because I always think of top 10s. But so what was your connection to that material?
To High Fidelity?
Yeah.
Well, of course, it was originally a British novel. And I guess I understand that. And John Cusack, I directed in The Grifters. There was nothing. I mean, oddly, well, I suppose the only thing I didn't particularly understand was the music, but I understood the book, the rest, everything else about the book. And once I'd got over the shock of transferring it from to the US from London, which didn't take long. As soon as I read the script, I realised that London was less important than I'd imagined. No, I felt very, very at home with it. And also, everybody else on the set was sort of world experts on music. So it was, I think, quite a relief. It was quite helpful that I knew nothing about music. I could judge everything from sort of different values and protect the film in some way.
One of the things I really like about the adaptation is, first of all, you preserve the voice of the writer Nick Hornby by doing a lot of voiceovers.
Yes. And in fact, that seemed very, very important.
Let's stop there for a second and play one of the voiceovers from the movie. And this is John Cusack, the used record store owner.
I own this store called Championship Vinyl. It's located in a neighborhood that attracts the bare minimum of window shoppers.
I get by because the people make a special effort to shop here. Mostly young men who spend all their time looking for deleted Smith singles and original, not re-released underline, Frank Zappa albums.
That's John Cusack in a scene from High Fidelity, which was directed by my guest, Stephen Frears. How is it difficult to direct convincing voiceovers like that in a movie in which we're actually seeing the characters talking to us? He's on camera talking to us.
Yes, in fact, we changed it. It was when I originally read the American script, it was voiceover, and we changed it to direct address because I thought it was so important. It was always clear to me that the book meant a lot to people. You know, that young people really cared about the book, and that you had to treat the book with tremendous respect. And one of the things that pleased me about the script that I read that was set in Chicago was that it showed you a way to get to the important bits of the book. And the important bits of the book are, in fact, unspoken thoughts. They're John Cusack's thoughts, really. So we were really always trying to find devices that would enable us to use the passages, these brilliant passages in Nick Hornby's book, which described the character's, you know, the inside of his head.
And something else I thought you really got right in the movie adaptation is the record store really looks like a used record store, and John Cusack's apartment is perfect. It's all kind of like sagging record shelves. You know, it's not one of these like TV sitcom apartments with a great big kitchen and a lovely living room. It's all record shelves.
Well, I know what it's like to have been a depressed young man. So I guess you start from that.
Did you?
Don't know. You're really only saying, well, you did your job well. You know, that was the job, to get that right. If you'd got that wrong, you wouldn't have made half as good a film.
Well, that's the point. You got your it right.
But there were people who would have, yes, but that's what I'm paid to do, is get it right. I mean, that's what I celebrate, really.
Right.
But there were people around, you know. I mean, if it had somehow looked the way you described, like something out of a sitcom, you know, John would have told me. I mean, people would have queued up to say how wrong we were. So we had a lot of experts on the set.
When you started to make movies, what year was that approximately?
I made my first film in 1967 and my first full-length film in 1970.
Okay, so what was going on then in the part of British film culture that you were most interested in?
It was about to be a rather poor time in British cinema. There was a very, very good time towards the end of the 50s and early 60s. Then it all became about music. The Beatles came, the Stones came. And music really took over from the movies. And all through the 70s, it was a very, very dull time in British cinema. We were all working in British television, which is where the good films were actually being made. And then it resurfaced again in the middle of the 80s when I made, well, the film that did it, I suppose. There were various things happened. There were all the films out of Goldcrest, Chariots of Fire, and then I made My Beautiful Laundrette. But that particular time, what I really remember about it is that the Americans left London. In other words, there are various periods when the American studios have offices in London and make films out of London. And then I guess when they start to lose money or the subject matter starts to run dry, the Americans go somewhere else. I'm sorry, I don't mean to sound anti-American.
So what was it about British television that made it a good place to be making movies in the 70s?
Well, we weren't really making movies. We were making films, and it was just a very, very creative period. television was quite new in Britain, and it was just where all the forward-thinking people were working. So when I was making films in the 70s, they were being written by the best writers in the country, they had the best actors in the country, and it was a sort of wonderful time to be working there. There was no commercial obligations at all. You simply made them, they went out. People were interested in them because, of course, there was a new subject, which was really the new Britain that was emerging.
Yeah, and the new Britain that was emerging, that's something that you really got in My Beautiful Laundrette.
Well, yes, that was, of course, later. No, I really mean the Britain that produced it, really, you know, the climax in the Beatles, really.
Oh, that Beatles, new Britain.
Yes, that new Britain. Well, the Beatles were the product of huge social changes which were tied up with the war.
Yeah, so how did you get to that in your movies? Like, what? How did you connect to those changes?
Well, I became one of the filmmakers who were making films about, not about the sort of traditional view of Britain, but about what it was like to be British at that particular moment, having experienced all those changes.
And what,
I mean, in a way, My Beautiful Laundrette was what it was like to be British in the middle of the 1980s.
Right.
And to have had that sort of legacy of empire.
Just getting back to the 70s for a second, what did the Beatles mean in your life? I mean, you're much deeper into film than into music, but did you feel the change either musically or culturally? Yeah. Can you talk about that?
There was a huge social change. I mean, basically, before the war, there was no working class culture. It simply didn't exist. And then, because of the war, there were changes in things like education. So suddenly, young working class people were being educated properly. And they started appearing. They started writing books, and they started making films, and they started making music. And eventually, they turned into the Beatles.
And
the Beatles before the war wouldn't have existed.
I guess that also opened the door to making movies and music about working class people.
Yes, that was really the big change that had happened.
Now, My Beautiful Laundrette, which was what year is it? It's 86 or something.
85, 86, yeah.
Yeah, so that's. A film set in the Margaret Thatcher era.
Yes.
And it's about being a new immigrant from Pakistan and being gay at the same time.
Yes. It's really about, the immigrants were people who, you know, they were the children of empire, really. The writer, Hanif Qureshi, was born in England and was brought up, you know, went to an English school, grew up with English kids. So that was what was really striking about it. It was the first time it was written from sort of inside.
Now, you more recently did a movie about immigrants in London, and this was about illegal immigrants.
Yes, and also not people to do with the empire. These were people from Turkey and Russia and Spain and places. I mean, nothing to do with the legacy of having had an empire. Empires are catastrophic things.
And what interested you in Dirty Pretty Things, the film about the illegal immigrants?
Because it made sense, like The Laundrette, it made sense of what I could see when I walked down the street and didn't understand. In other words, you started noticing that London was full of foreigners, and then suddenly there was a script that explained who they were and what they were doing there. Just as in The Laundrette, you know, the things that were around us, the newsagents, the grocers, all those sort of shops were run by Asians. And suddenly someone wrote a script which explained them and explained a lot of things that nobody had understood before. And the same with Dirty Pretty Things. It made sense of what it was like to walk down the street.
Now, of course, in Dirty Pretty Things, it's not like a documentary about immigrants. It's a mystery. It's a pretty hard-boiled, film noirish kind of thing about the underground economy in human organs.
Mm. Well, of course, by then I'd been to Hollywood and I'd learnt these corrupt habits. And what I always liked about the script was that it treated people as if they were in an American film, so that in the end these young, attractive immigrants sort of win. It wasn't like a normal pattern of a British film where you would treat people like that as victims. They were much more like the stars of an American film.
That's an interesting way of looking at it.
Mm. Well, I was very struck by that immediately and always liked it. I loved the fact that they won.
Now, when you started your movie career, you first were an assistant to Lindsay Anderson, who's most famous for the movie If, and then Carol Rice, who's most famous in the U.S. for his movie, The French Lieutenant's Woman. What are some of the things you learned from working with them?
Well, they were both extraordinary men, and they taught me, I mean, not just about films, they taught me about life. But if you were to ask what the lesson was, it was that there was a connection between the cinema and life. And maybe that's slightly gone away now. You know, I learnt how to live, really, from the cinema. You know, how to kiss girls, things like that. You learn large bit. You know, our lives in Britain were so narrow, were so unimaginative. And the world, I learnt about the world and growing up and things like that from films, because there wasn't anywhere else to learn them.
Now, which films taught you about, say, how to kiss a girl?
Oh, every high school film that was made in the 50s. I mean, not ones that were particularly famous, but, you know, just the whole introduction of American culture. I mean, I can remember first hearing Elvis. It was just astonishing to sit in England and hear these extraordinary people from the South. I didn't know the South existed in those days. We're a small island. We were so cut off from everything. And it was quite a hard time because of the war. So suddenly you were introduced to these very, very colourful alternative ways of living.
One of the things you've done in your career is discover some really interesting actors.
Yes, fantastic.
In High Fidelity, you have Jack Black and also Todd Luizzo, who's starting to become, I think, a little better known now. He played one of the guys in the
Record
Store.
He's a wonderful man.
Yeah, he's really good.
I mean, the truth is, I had no idea that Jack was going to act the way he did. You know, I thought he'd be good in the film, but I didn't know that what was about to emerge. So, you know, I could see I was the sort of midwife, and I must in some way have given him room to do that. I asked him afterwards why that had happened. And he said he'd always kept his head down, and suddenly someone said, well, why don't you stick your head up? But I wasn't really aware of what I was doing. I must have somehow made it comfortable for him to do that.
Well, why did you cast him? What did you see in him?
Well, the boys, you know, I was working with these three boys from Chicago. I said, who should play this part? And they just said Jack Black, without any doubt. And then when I was casting it, I met other people, but I never found anyone I thought would be as good as Jack. But that doesn't mean I knew what Jack was going to do. I hadn't seen Tenacious D and all that stuff he does. I just remember the first day that he shot, him starting, and I was just amazed. And then very, very soon realized that what he was doing was absolutely phenomenal, and I should just be grateful and shut up.
One more question about the Queen.
Yeah.
Did you run into any resistance in making the Queen, resistance to having a movie about the Queen, or about Tony Blair?
No, the palace are above these things. They neither approve nor disapprove. To take a position would be political, and they're, in that sense, non-political. I mean, there were a few people who owned castles in Scotland who, you know, thought it was somehow improper, but that just meant we had to look more carefully and be more imaginative. So, no, we ran into no trouble.
So now that you've made the Queen, are you hoping that one day you will be knighted by the Queen?
I don't expect to be knighted.
Well, this might be your thing here. No.
I say what Peter O'Toole says. I only accept awards from republics. That's a whole separate issue, the honours system. I mean, that's
Would you actually reject an award like that?
I'd probably be rather pleased to be offered it, but my wife would leave me.
Would she really?
I think so, yes.
So she's really opposed to the monarchy?
She's opposed to the privilege. It's really to do with privilege. And, you know, quite rightly, she's opposed to it. And I'd rather have my wife than an honour.
So she would try to convince you to decline?
She wouldn't try to. She'd succeed effortlessly with one blow of her handbag.
Well, Stephen Frears, a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Stephen Frears directed the new film, The Queen.